How did you happen to get in here?
I ran here. You scared the daylights out of me last night.
Seems like the truth shouldn't scare anybody, man or boy.
Thing getting you?
No. I'm just thinking about public reaction to all this.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to When It Was Cool Dark. I am your host, Carl Stern, from whenitwascool.com. This is episode number 346 of our program, and in our continuing series called 100 of the Darkest Moments in Pop Culture History, this is the 73rd installment of the 100 we're going to do. So we're almost three-fourths of the way through our series. This podcast is produced and distributed by whenitwascool.com. I hope you will check out and support our website at whenitwascool.com. We've got some great stuff up there. I want to call your attention very quickly to comic book fans. We did a Patreon-only series. It ran for 30 episodes called the When It Was Cool Comic Book Review, where we reviewed classic issues, groundbreaking landmark issues of various comic books over the years. And that series has been on our Patreon for quite a while. Well, as part of our restructuring for 2023, we're cleaning up some stuff. We're clearing some room on the shelf. So I've made those 30 episodes now free. So if you'll go to the front page of whenitwascool.com, you can easily access those shows. In case you're a comic book fan, want to save those for your archives, listen to them, and hopefully you'll enjoy that show as well. But we'll hope by whatever means you do so, you will support us here at When It Was Cool Dark and whenitwascool.com and our When It Was Cool podcasting network. So one of the things about this series, the 100 Darkest Moments in Pop Culture History is it can be a kind of a downer. I mean, let's be honest. We've talked about a lot of deaths, a lot of tragedies, and yeah, that can get to weighing on you after a while. But not everything that was a dark moment in pop culture history necessarily involved tragedy. Didn't involve death. Didn't involve some sort of horrific incident. My goodness, last week's show about the 1972 Olympics was, yeah, I mean, that's a real downer any way you look at it. I mean, it is full of tragedy and botched response. I mean, it's just got every earmark of a real downer of a show. So I thought this week we would talk about a dark moment in pop culture history that didn't involve someone dying, for Pete's sake, or something that tragic, but it still was a negative turning point in popular culture. It did make a comeback. Some suggest it's on the verge of another dark moment, but we'll talk about that as well. But let's talk about something that many of us were involved in probably throughout our childhood for sure, but certainly if you were around in the late 1980s through about the mid-1990s, you probably were a trading card collector, sports card, baseball cards, football cards. Goodness, every genre of popular entertainment had some sort of trading card back during that time period. And these were everywhere. I mean, every branch of pop culture had some sort of trading card. I remember when comic books even got in on it. Baseball cards had been around for a long, long time before that and had been a staple of, youth sports collectibles. I mean, it was just one of the things you did. Even if you weren't a big baseball fan, you probably at some point in time had baseball cards or football cards or something of that nature. Well, it became big business in the late 1980s into the early 1990s. About the same time, really, comic books started skyrocketing in appeal. So did trading cards. And it was probably because it was riding a wave of nostalgia previously. Our parents grew up also on baseball cards and comic books. And so it worked its way back around. Many of the comic books and trading cards of our parents' youth were now worth a lot of money. My parents, my dad was born in 1951. So obviously comic books from the very late golden age into the early silver age of comics were worth a lot of money. So what he knew was, you know, the comic books I saw as a kid are now worth hundreds or thousands of dollars. The baseball cards he would have collected when he was a kid, many of them were worth hundreds and thousands of dollars, particularly if it was a very, very successful player of some sort, rookie cards and things like that. And so they encourage their children to collect the same things, right? We do the same stuff. We pass along our likes to the next generation in hopes that they will get the same sort of fulfillment, enjoyment we got out of those same things. Well, the problem was the difference between it was mass production. Okay, the reason those comic books, the reason those baseball cards were worth so much was they had far smaller runs back when dad was a kid, back when grandpa was a kid. If you kept those around, people didn't usually think in that direction. Hey, I'm going to keep this baseball card in pristine condition. I'm going to keep it in a climate controlled box in a Mylar sleeve and really take care of it so it's going to be in pristine condition in 30 years so I can sell it for thousands of dollars. No, of course not. They clipped it on their bicycle to make a motorcycle noise when you rode it. You traded it with your friends. You stuck it in your pocket. You did all those things. And so the fact that there were much smaller print runs to begin with that weren't taken as well a care of, you folded a comic book up and put it in your back pocket, that led to scarcity. Well, flip it around 30 years later, you're now, 1989, 1990, right in there, and these card companies, these comic book companies are playing on that nostalgia, playing on that, and look, hey, beyond collectability, there is fun in that, right? There's fun in collecting these, especially in the trading card industry where there were so many different genres being produced. I mean, like I said, I've never was a big baseball fan myself, but I liked football. I certainly liked comic books. I liked pro wrestling. I liked various TV shows, and everything had a trading card. Marvel Comics came out with their trading cards, and so you go to a comic book shop, and hey, I've got one of the rare hologram cards. How much is it worth? Oh, it's worth $10 or $12 now. Well, of course it's going to be worth hundreds of dollars in the future. Let's collect these. Let's save these. I remember I still have an unopened box of G.I. Joe trading cards. I was a big G.I. Joe collector. Those things are essentially worthless, as are many of the cards that came from that era. I had the Andy Griffith Show trading cards. There were multiple different pro wrestling company trading cards from WWF, WCW. WCW, the smaller of the companies, had two different versions of trading cards, and some of them were really nice. And so I got in big with the football trading cards for a while, and there was always something out there that was interesting and just grabbed your attention. You go to a flea market, which is another thing that's kind of gone by the wayside as far as popular culture goes, replaced by things like eBay and the Facebook marketplace and stuff like that. You killed off the flea market business. But in the early 1990s, if you went to a flea market, it was just about a guarantee that in a large size flea market, you would find four or five comic book and collectible dealers and probably 10 trading card or baseball card, football card dealers as well. And it was just a fandom market. Every town of any size whatsoever had at least one or two card shops. And fans would go. It would become a passion. It would become a really fun thing to do. But it also was plagued by the same thing that happened to the comic book market, which we've previously talked about in this series of the 100 darkest moments in pop culture history. It got greedy. It got invaded by speculators who were not there for any love of baseball or football or comic books or TV shows. They were there to try to make a buck. They were there to, get a rookie car. NASCAR, there's big NASCAR cards as well. They were there to try to capitalize monetarily on these pop culture things. And so when there was no scarcity to it, there were millions of these cards produced. There were millions of comic books produced in this time period that was going through a similar thing. And ultimately, both markets crashed, incredibly so. Comic books never really truly recovered. Now, comic books did come back. They really changed. They went to a direct market. They went to being collected in collected editions and sold through bookstores and Amazon. And so the face of what comic book collecting was changed, but it was never, ever nearly as big as what it was back then. Trading cards did manage. It took 30 years, but they did manage to make a comeback. And in a way, really changed for our kids and grandkids now. While people my age, people Generation Xers, for example, and maybe some of the older millennials, still collect sports cards, still collect baseball cards and things like that, and that market has definitely made a comeback, especially in recent years. It's down a little bit in 2022, but in the previous few years, it too made a pretty good comeback. But our children got into card games, things like Pokemon and things like Magic the Gathering, and those cards gained astronomical prices for some of the more rare and collectible ones of those. And that became a passionate thing that is still ongoing from that. So there's something about the portability, I think, the ease of access, and the trying to chase a rarity, trying to chase a specialty of a card that is appealing to, I think, everybody. And whether your thing is sports or whether your thing is TV and entertainment, Star Wars cards were a big thing back when in my youth, or it's something like a collectible game, like, again, Pokemon or something like that. There's something fun about that. There's something about the fun about the trading, the playing, the using, the having, the collecting of these that is largely appealing. And we're going to talk about the market as it's changed and as it's come back and as it has both risen and fallen multiple times just in my lifetime. As a young kid in the 1970s, I started off when baseball cards and football cards were still very collectible, and then saw the peak there in the very late 1980s, especially in the early 1990s. I saw the market utterly crash where you can't give these cards away, and that stuck around for a long time. eBay, when it came around, it just, instead of re-energizing that market, it actually just added to the fact that these things weren't scarce. They were very many of them in all degree of, unless you just had something of extraordinary rarity and quality, your gigantic card collection was utterly useless. But then we saw it kind of make a comeback a little bit just in recent years. So let's dive a little deeper in. And I want to take a look at an article from a website called allvintagecards.com. And this is from back last year, March of last year, and it's titled, "Here's Why the Sports Card Market Crashed in the 1990s and Why It Might Happen Again." And I think this is an outstanding article by, again, allvintagecards.com that really breaks down the thing about trading cards. And one of the darkest moments, I contend, in popular culture history was both the comic book and trading card crash of the 1990s, where all this fun collectible for multiple generations, at least two generations, had all sorts of fun chasing these, many people dedicating lots of money and lots of time in their life to chasing these various cards of whatever their hobby was, only to see it become utterly meaningless in a very short span of time. And so I think it was profoundly impactful as far as popular culture goes. The article states, "I was only 9 years old when I started collecting back in 1985. I got a few packs of 1985 Tops and was hooked. As a kid that loved baseball, those little pieces of cardboard were everything to me. So the writer of this article is a few years younger than me, though not much. And so we're probably, you know, close contemporaries. So I imagine this is going to probably echo my same feelings and sentiments, even though I am a few years older, I'm 3 or 4 years older than this person. The article continues, "I was obsessed right away, and it consumed my entire being, ranging from riding my bike 3 miles to the nearest baseball card store and setting up tables in my basement for a baseball card show amongst my friends. My brother soon opened a baseball card store, and I was quickly thrown into battle as a high schooler peddling cards and negotiating purchases. I lived through the peak of the, quote, junk era, in which cards were massively overproduced. Yet at the time, I didn't grasp the realities of what was happening with the values of cards. I returned to the hobby several years after college and slowly started getting interested in cards again, which ultimately led to the launch of All Vintage Cards website. I've discussed my thoughts about the current market exhibiting signs of being in a bubble territory, but this time I wanted to examine the current market environment in relation to the last big card bubble from the 1990s. The author of this article says that they lived through it, sort of always chalked up the bursting card bubble to overproduction, but figured there had to be more to it. Thus, they went to the archives, did some more extensive research, and spoke to other people in the hobby. Thus, here are the results of this writer's exploration into the card sports card bubble from the 1990s. Note, if you lived through it and have a different perspective, or you just want to leave your thoughts on my findings, please leave a comment. So I'm anxious to see if my experience differs from his. I dealt in sports cars, sure. I was mostly comic book selling. I did flea markets and stuff in the early 1990s, predominantly selling comic books, action figures, and pro wrestling related memorabilia. But certainly, I mean, just by osmosis, you had, Trey, I can remember 2 or 3 folders full of cards, and many times getting, you know, that in trades and things like that. And while I never considered myself an expert in it, now comic book cards were a different story. I did a deal in those. It was, I mean, you couldn't escape it. It was everywhere. The article continues, massive print runs were mostly unknown by collectors in the 80s and 90s. In the thick of the madness during the 1980s, no one really had any idea that most print runs for major card sets were in the multiple millions. There was no internet. The only way to communicate with other collectors was via local card shows or stores. It wasn't until the mid-1990s when eBay launched that collectors started to figure out how massive the existing supplies were. So this goes along right in line with what I had mentioned earlier, and this was my experience too. The article continues, publications such as Beckett, Tough Stuff, and Sports Collectors Daily kept a pulse on the hobby and provided collectors with pricing. However, those publications never discussed the actual print runs for each of the major card companies, and the card companies themselves did not disclose this information. And also, I think it should be noted that some of these magazines were either owned by or a slave to the advertising from these card companies to begin with, so they weren't going to bite the hand that fed them, so to speak. The focus was more about who were the next big rookies to collect. This led to more of an investment mindset, as collectors realized they could earn sizable profits. Just buy a few packs and resell the individual cards from the boxes at a massive profit. This same mindset happened with comic books. Buy number ones, number one, number one, number one, regardless of how obviously the quality had dropped, how massive the print runs was. That's why people still this day, there's probably comic shops around that have boxes full of X-Men number one and X-Force number one and all this stuff. Just get in there, right? It's a rookie card, essentially, for comic books. The article continues, one of the poster child cards of the junk era was none other than the Ken Griffey Jr. 1989 Upper Deck rookie card. At the time, Upper Deck was a brand new entrant to the scene and part of a new game plan to increase the quality and cost of new cards. Griffey's Upper Deck rookie card became the must-own card and the one that was going to facilitate early retirement for the young and old. Yet, no one quite knew the extent to which Upper Deck was hitting the printing presses. While it was a premium product and likely produced in fewer quantities than other early junk-era Topps issues, it is still estimated that Upper Deck produced over 1 million copies of the card. Thus the greed, and huge and unknown at the time, oversupply from card manufacturers is one of the big reasons that the hobby burst in a big way. This quote is from Dave Jameson, who wrote the excellent book Mint Condition. It was greed on the part of card makers because they rolled out so much product that it was diluted, that it diluted the power of the cards and killed the golden goose. It was greed on the part of the baseball union because they sold a lot of rights and made a lot of royalties on those rights until they had too many card makers. Then you had greed on the part of dealers, surly guys who didn't care to talk to the 9-year-olds who came to their shops and were just there to sell cards. As you can imagine, this sort of wool over the eyes in regards to production run numbers led to some pretty disappointed collectors who saw their card values go up in flames. The proliferation of card stores and shops helped to fuel the access to cards, as did the price guides such as Beckett, which helped add a sort of formal stamp of approval to the ridiculous prices that some collectors were handing over for these massively produced cards. Some of the junk era stuff, including the Griffey Jr. Upper Deck card, are coming back to life, especially higher graded copies. Although the writer of this article feels that collectors might again be ignoring the facts about existing supplies of these cards. I would also note that despite the card crash of the 1990s, rarer vintage cards were mostly immune from the same sort of massive decline witnessed by many of those cards produced during the junk era. Today's market is being fueled in large part by investment funds pooling capital to invest in high-dollar cards. Hedge funds, card breakers, and fractional interest platforms such as Collectible are likely behind the hard-to-explain increase witnessed over the past few months. Back in the 1980s and 90s, when I was collecting, I was too young to even think about if there were big investors playing the game. I'm sure there were, but I don't think it was a hedge fund game at the time. Sure, I believe there were likely investors with deep pockets joining the hobby to try and buy higher-priced cards to resell for profit, but I think it was more of a retail frenzy than anything else. When I worked at my brother's card store in the early 1990s, it was less driven by kids and more about adults that were chasing packs in hopes of landing a big insert. Kind of a big-time gambler's mentality, and something I think is very similar to modern packs inserting chase and or card breaks of today. It was less about big investors and more about collectors and non-hobbyists realizing they could buy a $1, $2, or $5 pack and more than quadruple their investment. With the lack of information available on card supply, there was typically a buyer on the other side willing to pay a higher-than-warranted premium. The perception was soon coming into play that baseball cards were now a viable option for investing your money. Word of 5 to 6 auction sales for a T206 Wagner or the 52 Topps Mantle started to lead collectors into a false sense of hope. Collectors, or more likely speculators, were snapping up 100 card lots of rookies such as Todd Van Poppel, Brian Taylor, Sam Horn, and Ellis Burks, with the hope that once those guys hit it big, they would have a fortune on their hands. Little did they know that those 100 card lots basically represented far less than 1% of the existing population, 0.00001%, actually. Should be noted that many collectors were also hoarding unopened wax boxes at the time, thinking that in 20 years it would be worth a fortune. Unfortunately, despite some minor exceptions, the majority of the junk wax from the 80s and 90s is worth less now than the original retail value. The frenzy in the market started to get seriously out of control by the early 1990s, when according to one resource, there were as many as 80 companies producing trading cards. The day of the 25-cent and 50-cent packs with a stick of gum were long gone by this time. It became less of a hobby and more of a platform to make a quick buck. Those 25 and 50-cent packs became two $5 and $10 packs, and the pure hobbyists, which were mostly younger kids, were completely priced out of the hobby. The pure greed in the hobby led to a dumpster fire of overproduction and pure blindness as to the worthlessness of the cards being produced. Insert cards started becoming more of the norm, but still with unknown production ranges. It was this mania that started to drive the pure collectors out of the hobby altogether. On August 12, 1994, Major League Baseball was put on pause and ultimately the season was canceled, with resolution not happening until 235 days later. The World Series was canceled, leaving many in the hobby sort of panicking as to how a canceled baseball season might affect the hobby. It was the fuel that the fire needed to blow up in its entirety. Casual baseball fans that started collecting were no longer interested. It wasn't long before many of the speculators also left the hobby en masse, leading to a free fall in card prices, ultimately cementing the history as one of the biggest non-stock market bubbles in history. And I would throw comic books in there as well, ironically around the same time period. Are there any parallels between the 90s card market burst and today's card market? And remember, this article is about a year old, and there does seem to be indications that the upturn in the card market has turned down some. This article says yes. First, let's just say I have some concerns. Whether it's with the vintage or modern card market, things have moved up at an unstable rate. There are definitely some things in common with the 1990s bubble. First, there's a lot of greed rampant through the hobby and elsewhere, which is evidenced by the throngs of speculators that have entered the market. As I've always noted, the entrance of private equity and investment funds into the space is a major concern for me. How many everyday collectors are now getting priced out of some of the more iconic rookie cards in the hobby? The speculators and the big-pocketed investors are taking over. I'm afraid that for many cards that have seen tenfold price increases in less than a year, there will ultimately be a lack of buyer at a higher price on the other end. When it ends is anyone's guess, but let's just remember that things can't go up in a straight line forever. That's my opinion. And I have seen similar things. I haven't really paid any attention to the comic book card market in a long time, but I can tell you about pro wrestling cards, which have largely been utterly worthless. Even, you know, back in the day when they were produced and were popular, they were utterly worthless because it was a very niche genre in popular culture, much less in the trading card market. Well, I noticed a couple of years ago, on things like Twitter and Facebook and eBay, these cards were going up ridiculously, especially rarer ones, ones that didn't have quite the print run of, say, the early 1990s WCW Impel cards and those things, which had a large print runs. I mean, you could still buy unopened boxes of those regular, pretty cheap 20 years after the fact. But some of the more rare cards, especially graded ones, and this really seemed to be where whatever is happening is really happening with the grading high-quality cards. And these things were going through the roof. And, you know, it doesn't take a genius to know that something that has been largely worthless for 25, 30 years is not suddenly going to grow, 10 times over in price and demand that quickly. And so one has to wonder if there are some sort of forces behind the work for that collector's market as well. So let's take our mid-show break. When we come back, we're going to take a look at an article that says, that asks the question, appropriately so, why are your sports cards from the early 1990s worthless? And we'll give some more observations about the current card climate, much, much more in our series 100 of the Darkest Moments in Pop Culture History. We'll be right back after this.
Excuse me, please. Let's don't talk negatively. Speaking of winners, surprise, surprise, whenitwascool.com is your home for retro pop culture articles and podcasts. To all our patron supporters, this is for you, Fannie Mae. Solid gold just like you and me. Family friendly and fun. WhenItWasCool.com.
Again, let me remind you, we have up for free some of our 30, in fact, of our podcast, the When It Was Cool comic review podcast. These are shows where we reviewed classic comic books. They've, for ever since their existence, they've been available on our Patreon page. And now they are available for free for you to download and check out. Go to the front page of WhenItWasCool.com and help yourselves to them. And I hope you'll listen to those shows and think, hey, there is something remarkably fun going on over here at WhenItWasCool.com. Perhaps I should become a Patreon where I can get immediate access to over 2,000 shows in their archives dealing with retro pop culture and more. Hope you'll do that because that's what keeps us going. Without our Patreons and especially new Patreons, well, we can't keep going. We can't produce this show and the other ones we do as well. So check us out at whenitwascool.com. Now, I want to reference an article called CardboardConnection.com. CardboardConnection.com. Why your sports cards from the early 1990s are worthless. It's a familiar scene in sports card shops. Someone walks in enthusiastically with a faded box or two under their arms. They confidently toss them on the glass display case, look up at the card shop owner, and ask, "How much will you give me for these?" expecting high sports card values. Seeing the mix of Fleer team logo stickers and Upper Deck holograms tattooing the box, the shopkeeper knows the customer won't be leaving the store happy or with a newfound wad of cash. But he opens the box anyway out of curiosity. Before the shop owner even has a chance to take out a handful of cards, the customer amps up the sales pitch. "I've got tons of Hall of Famers in there. At Nolan Ryan, where he's wearing the tuxedo, I've got two of them. Same with the Upper Deck card, where there's three pictures of him. Those were some great cards back when they were first released, but they aren't going to put anyone through college today, let alone buy a ham sandwich." Sports card values from the late 1980s and early 1990s are pretty much worthless, with some notable exceptions. The shop owner continues to thumb through the cards politely as the collector, now completely overcome with visions of upcoming riches, points out can't-miss rookies like Greg Vaughn, Greg Jeffries, and Kevin Moss. "I know some of them didn't quite pan out, but they should be worth a little something still, right?" asks the collector. Nope. As the shop owner nears the bottom of the stack, the collector reaches in and grabs one card. "This card's awesome. Check it out. Michael Jordan taking batting practice with the White Sox. Last time I looked this up in a price guide, these bad boys were selling for $20. Same with the Dream Team Jose Canseco. This collector knew his stuff. The only problem was the last time the 1991 Upper Deck Baseball Michael Jordan sold for more than a dollar was back then. Saved by the Bell was still on the air, and Reebok was rocking the Foot Locker with pump shoes. The shop owner carefully puts the cards back in the box and thanks the customer for bringing them in. "So what can I get for them?" the collector asks. "Sorry, I can't use them." "What do you mean?" "I've already got more than I can use, but I paid a lot for these cards back in the day." "I understand. So did I, but they're not worth much anymore." "How much?" The dance goes back and forth for a couple minutes. The shop owner just wants to tell the guy that if he wanted to get rid of his cards, he might as well use them for kindling. But he holds back and continues to try and let him down as nicely and educate him about the real-world sports card values. The collector is shocked and can't understand it. For all these years, he's been careful to keep the corners sharp and not creased. But the fact is, very few sports cards from the late 1980s to the early 1990s have much value. In fact, many are hard to give away today. But not all hope is lost for those looking to cash in on their sports card stashes from the era. This sounds almost identical to comic books from that same era. Virtually word for word, you could replace sports cards with comic books. The article goes on and continues to explain, to put it bluntly, everyone who wants a 1991 Upper Deck Baseball Michael Jordan has three of them. Even if they were just one per box, tons are out there. literally. Today, they can be found for pennies on the dollar. This is the same with almost every sports card made between 1986 and 1992. When sports cards began to emerge as collectibles, more people started to buy in. Soon after the price, after that came price guides, which placed specific values on collections. The hobby then enjoyed exponential growth. Everyone was suddenly dreaming of Jose Canseco and Todd Van Poppel cards working like stocks. Sports card values were supposed to see steady climbs, eventually culminating in cashing in for college tuition, new cars, and lavish weddings. Baseball cards of a shirtless Jose Canseco were worth $20 or more. Heck, 1986 Donruss Jose Canseco cards were going for more than $100. The 1991 Upper Deck Baseball SP1 Michael Jordan was selling for $25. But in this time of card shops on every corner, everybody was forgetting about one of the most basic rules of economics, supply and demand. When millions of people were buying sports cards in the late 1980s and early 1990s, card companies had press runs to match, with few exceptions. There were always enough cards to go around. Collectors could easily buy single cards by the brick. You wanted 100 Todd Van Poppel rookie cards from the 1991 Upper Deck for every member of your football team? No problem. Heck, you could get 500 card lots relatively easy. It seemed like everyone was stashing sports cards and lots of them. Supply and demand were in line, so prices were strong. The mass supply should have been a major tip-off that made the continuous growth of sports card valuables impossible. As the hobby hemorrhaged collectors, supply now far exceeded demand. The hordes of cards didn't disappear, they merely sat in closets for years, gathering dust. Now many sports card collectors are looking to get something for their cards. They're nostalgic, not so much for the players on the front of the cards, but rather the rush of bumping elbows at card shows as they built equity for their future. The hobby was filled with investors, not collectors. That's not a knock on anyone's reasons for buying cards. We were all told the sports cards were easy money. Who's going to turn down easy money, especially when it was fun to collect? Supply has long since caught up with demand. Pallets of unopened cases and shoeboxes of childhood collections are common. If you're looking to sell your late 1980s and early 1990s cards, you're not alone. Cards are worthless because no one's buying. Don't blame the card shop owner for not wanting them. They won't be able to sell them. So if they take them off your hands, they're merely adding to a potential fire hazard. And again, that is very, very accurate to what comic books were doing. The article concludes by saying, not all hope's lost for those of you who have boxes and boxes of cards that aren't worth any money. You may not be able to cash in and take that vacation you were hoping for, or even buy a textbook for your daughter's first semester at college, but some value can be found. Several sets from the late 1980s and early 1990s are still very attractive sets. Okay, maybe not the hideous yellow of the 1991 Fleer baseball, but early Upper Deck sets are gorgeous. Rather than lamenting on false hopes, take out your cards and look through them. Admire the photography, the designs, player accomplishments. If you were a hardcore investor, this might have even passed you by 20 years ago in the rush to keep the cards in mint condition. You may choose to get rid of some of the cards and only keep your favorite teams or players. Even then, who needs a brick of 1990 Upper Deck Kevin Moss cards? One will probably do. At this point, you've got little to lose with your overproduced cards. The monetary sports card values aren't there. Enjoy the cards for what they are, and don't get mad over what they could have been. If you insist on freeing up space and your collection consists solely of cards from 1986 to 1992, don't bother taking them to your local card shop unless you have rookie cards of Hall of Fame stars. Even then, prepare to be disappointed. Outside of a couple of exceptions like 1989 Upper Deck Baseball, 1989 Score Football, 1990 Leaf, 1991 Stadium Club Football, and 1992 Bowman Baseball, you're still likely to be turned away. And if you do take your cards from this era to be appraised, don't get mad at the guy behind the counter when he breaks it to you that the sports card values are worthless. Chances are he's probably got a basement filled with them too. So it was, you know, who can forget? It was absolutely a fun time, to be sure. I mean, you know, if you had fun chasing those cars, chasing those sets, I used to really love the, especially like the really nice football cards. And like I said, WCW had, pro wrestling had a gorgeous set of cards that was done, I think, by Impel, that was just very, very nice cards, very slick, beautiful cards, fun to look at, not worth very much. Those Marvel cards, comic book cards, those were fun. Chasing those holograms. Oh, I got a, you know, a hologram. It was all a good time. And I guess unless you just sunk a fortune in it, it was, you know, kind of harmless fun. Not exactly the best investment you can make, but harmless fun nevertheless. The comic books from that time period, certainly you could read those, although 1990s comics, some of those weren't really worth reading either. But we chased them, right? We chased them. We loved them. We had fun. I have no doubt many of you still have boxes and boxes. I have really, over the years, I've managed to get pretty much rid of all my trading cards. I think I have I still have one unopened box of G.I. Joe trading cards, so if you're interested. But I have those for my collection just because I've got a big G.I. Joe action figure collection. I've got that just to go along with them. I think I paid $10 for it back 20 years ago, and it's probably worth $10 now today. But hey, it's still there. It's a curiosity. You know, if I were to show people my collection, they might say, hey, wow, you know, an open box, you know, it really has no monetary value, but I guess it's a cool little thing to have there. And a few trading cards for different comic book properties as well. But mostly, yeah, trading cards, not so much so. And I hope the kids today that are having spending a lot of time chasing, you know, their Magic the Gathering and Yu-Gi-Oh! And things like that are having a good time with it. And certainly they play these card games, and I don't even pretend to understand how some of these games work, but there's obviously a lot of fun to it. There are huge groups that play these cards, collect these cards, and chase these cards. And I hope they're getting their money's worth for the fun that it is. And I hope the speculators don't overtake their hobby as well. I hope it is a hobby done for fun and enjoyment for what it is, rather than chasing the false hopes of an investment down the road. Or it could turn into one of the darkest moments in pop culture history, which I feel like the trading card bubble bursting certainly was. How many thousands of people bought these cards in mass, most times overpaying for them back in the circa 1991, 1992. I saw them at flea markets all the time. I saw $100 bills going down quite often to get just a few cards that now, sadly, are utterly worthless for the most part. Hopefully that didn't happen to you, but I suspect it probably did to many of you. Hey, I had the comic books the same way. I can remember 20 years ago, I guess, flipping through one of my long boxes of comics and going, wow, you know, this one's worth $300. This one's worth $200. This is worth, you know, now you couldn't give them away. I got rid of all my physical comics several years ago, and thankfully so, because they were all utterly worthless. I gave most of them away, quite frankly, because, again, nobody wanted to buy those. They were printed in the millions, just like these trading cards were. So let's be wiser. Let the rule of thumb be, are you having fun? If the answer to that's yes, then carry on. If it's, I know I'm doing this as an investment because it's going to be worth something one day, I would reevaluate what I'm doing, because it's literally a house of cards. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for joining us here for When It Was Cool Dark. Perhaps you know this show is Dragon King Dark over at WrestlingObserver.com, Figure4Online.com, the Dark Matter Digital Network. Wherever you're hearing this show, I hope you will support us at WhenItWasCool.com. Hey, do me a favor, if you would, here before the year's over with, can I ask you just one favor? whatever podcast catcher you've got, whether it's iTunes, Apple Podcast, Amazon, Spotify, whatever, if you would go to podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts from, and just type in the words, "When It Was Cool," that's going to bring you up three podcasts. It's going to bring you up When It Was Cool Retro Pop Culture Podcast, When It Was Cool Wrestling Podcast, and When It Was Cool Dark. If you could subscribe to all three of those free shows, then hey, you're in the door with us at whenitwascool.com. Welcome to our world. You're going to find some really fun stuff there, hopefully really educational stuff, hopefully some stuff that's going to carry you back to a time where you really enjoyed pop culture and had different likes and interests in it, and we're going to talk about those. And once you're here, I think you'll really enjoy what we do. You hear me talk a lot about our Patreon. That is ultimately where we stay in business. Without it, we don't exist, quite frankly. So I hope you will ultimately, if you like those shows, become a Patreon supporter where you get access to exclusive shows. We put up a show just about every single day on our Patreon feed, and you'll get those shows plus a back catalog of over 2,000 shows at this point. So check us out. Go to your podcast aggregator, your podcatcher, type in the words When It Was Cool and those three shows. Subscribe to, share, tell people on social media about it, and bookmark our website, whenitwascool.com. Love to see you there. Thank you so much for supporting the show, and we'll see you back here again soon. Here's a soundbite from the When It Was Cool podcast from whenitwascool.com. Uncle Luke of Two Live Crew, and I wouldn't have thought of Two Live Crew again in my life probably had I not brought him up on this show. That, I bet you didn't listen to a lot of Two Live Crew back in the day, did you?
I was aware of it.
Okay, so I wasn't going to set you up and say, let's play some Two Live Crew, Tanya.
I'm aware. We was listening to some of the songs. I think I got my first kick, my first feel of it at the fair. And I'm like, wow, this is some...
Who is playing Two Live Crew at the fair? What? What kind of fair was this? What?
I
mean,
I remember it being, I was on like that Polar, that it was called, it was a ride because called the Polar, and it slung you around real fast.
Okay, tell me more.
And I can remember this song being on, and I can remember it was started going really, really fast, and I was thinking, okay, this song is really, really dirty.
Yes.
And there was little kids on there.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm thinking.
I mean, not on the ride, but there was little kids around, and I was thinking, this song is really bad.
You can get more from this podcast and many others by going to whenitwascool.com. And remember, support us on Patreon.
If you liked what you heard, go to whenitwascool.com.
This is the sound of the 80s. Everybody's looking for it, and we've got it.
And hit that Patreon button.
If you'll excuse me, I need to go buy a new Cyndi Lauper CD and have myself a little cry.